the last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
Now, our next guest is a former Finn Harps footballer, but he's now an academic based at the University of Bath in England, and he is a leading authority on the changing relationship between gambling and sport. And that's the subject of his first book, Imitation Games: How Gambling Hijacks Sport. Darren McGee, thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, in what way do you mean has gambling hijacked sport?
Well, I guess the book adopts a kind of two-decade frame for that. And what I argue is that since the turn of the century, gambling firms have changed quite radically. What we understand by the term gambling has changed quite radically. And what I mean by that is this is an industry no longer kind of tethered to the race course or a day at the races. This is an industry revolutionized by the advent of the internet, then the smartphone, the rise of social media, data science, all in essence that the big tech giants of the Silicon Valley kind of unleashed. And so I guess I'm talking about this new age engineering of what gambling is. And that gave rise to a new wave of online gambling brands. And they had kind of a challenge a couple of decades ago, and that was to reduce the age of their punters. They understood that to stay profitable, they needed to move beyond horse racing. And all that meant reframing gambling as something quite new for a new generation. And of course, they set their sights on football more than any other sport. And through football, the hijacking that I lay out is becoming genius marketers is, I guess, the first thing to say. They spent billions annually on marketing and did it incredibly well. An argument I set out in the book is that gambling firms are arguably at the frontier of what marketing becomes since the early noughties. They sponsored football clubs, they partnered with leagues, they recruited athletes and celebrities to legitimate kind of the industry and particular products. They designed an entire new range or paradigm of products like in-play betting, which I'm sure we'll talk about.
We will. I really want to get to that. But actually, just before we get to all of that, I just want to go back a little bit, just briefly, because I grew up in the 20th century when bookies were regarded by parents or children almost in the same way of pubs. I'd be as afraid to come out of a bookies as I would be to come out of a pub and get caught by my father or whatever. What happened that moved gambling from being what was regarded by many as a sort of a public health risk to being essentially a branch of the entertainment industry? How did that come about?
Well, I mean, it's a remarkable piece of kind of corporate engineering to overturn what was, as you've laid out there, a century's worth of kind of moral apathy. And I lay out my first bet, you know, that I placed in Donegal as an 18-year-old. And it's exactly as you say, you know, I didn't want to tell my father where I was going. I lied to my granny, whose house is very close to where the bookmaker was. And it was exactly that. It was something that was quite seedy. And I guess, you know, the direct answer to your question is a mix of things. Technology definitely changes that. You can't underestimate the extent to which the smartphone makes all this seem kind of more modern, more amenable to a younger generation. But you also can't underestimate everything I've laid out there in terms of the marketing. And that is seeing national heroes and icons tell you that this is part of fandom. Yes, this is key. There's a reason that in the UK they spend $2 billion on marketing every year, you know, and it's not just about volume, it's about the framing. You know, framing gambling as a kind of add-on to fandom was a genius piece of the puzzle, really.
And I have to admit, Dara, I would have fallen for it. We would have fallen for here in the last word for a period where we used to have Tony Cascarino on a Friday as part of his preview of all the Premier League games, give us a treble, you know, that was done for charity, whatever, until a few years ago, we just said, no, let's stop this. This is not right. And let's move on a little bit more on football, because you mentioned there about things like Martin O'Neill was in the studio late last year and the two of us were going on about how much we hate things like expected goals and other data points which are now coming in and influencing football. But reading what you've written, it sort of strikes me at that actually this is all about providing other metrics by which bets can be placed.
Yeah, the data revolution is part of all this, you know. It's absolutely, and that's the surveillance. There's two dimensions to that. Fandom's been changed by data. You know, I was doing another interview earlier, and I just spoke about the first time in a pub I found myself talking about the heat map of one of my favorite And that's a real moment to check yourself when kind of, you know, fan punditry in the pub is talking about heat maps. And I think there's, you know, all of us as sports fans today, we have adopted that language, the language of XG, as you put it, and the rest of them. And so that's penetrated fandom in a way. And
Darren, you haven't ever jumped up, have you, when your team, like when Finn Harps gets their 10th corner of the game, because that means your quid's in?
No, that hasn't happened to me yet. No,
but it has happened to other people.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's kind of the warped, I speak in the book about the warped nature of fandom amongst all this. And of course, I find myself being asked a lot about kind of the more serious harms connected to gambling and, you know, and habitual patterns. And the truth is, one of the things that the book lays out is the very mundane loss of what fandom can be. Yes, there's a kind of melancholy, a sadness to fandom, in the sense that a lot of fans get into the rhythm that you've just mentioned, betting against their team so that either way there's a high, there's a dopamine hit. And all of this kind of rewires fandom in ways that I think we don't think enough about. Yes. And yeah, that's just as important to the book.
Because you actually bring a very important point out there. Why is it necessary? I mean, I'm old enough to remember my first World Cup that I can remember is 1974, and the tournaments in 78 and 82 and 86. And I can remember great games and great goals and great moments. And I can remember those. I don't need to remember having a fiver on something to happen in a match and that being something to remember later on in life.
No, that's right. What you're laying out there is the kind of social dimension to all this, you know, and of course, there is an irony that a lot of the marketing for gambling draws on the social dimension. It actually, you know, in many ways sells gambling as an add-on to your social life, something to do, something to discuss among friends. But the reality, of course, is that, you know, it is solitary. It has added a kind of isolation to fandom. Even when you're sitting amongst friends, a lot of young men I find, or they tell me, I'm somewhere else. Yes, the somewhere else being in the title of the book, Imitation Games. And so absolutely, to be fair though, you can't lay all of that at the door of the gambling firms. We all live in an attention economy now, and it's fair to say we're all being drawn in different directions. And that purist take on your first World Cup, I mean, yeah, part of me thinks that there is something about fandom that's been lost there. Gambling's just part of that.
Well, let's do talk about the gambling firms, so, and particularly the Irish element in this, because it has to be said, and Stuart Kenny is somebody I know very well. He's been a guest on this programme many times in recent years, and there's a sense of regret, I think, to Stuart as to how this all developed, even though he was very involved in building up Paddy Power bookmakers. How important were Paddy Power and other Irish bookies to what has happened?
I mean, the story is extraordinary. You know, I had to check myself at several points in kind of research and writing this book that this firm that in many ways was under fire from, you know, the Brits, as they were labelled at the time, you know, the big British bookmakers who were more powerful and more profitable. I mean, Paddy Power kind of is born out of the need to resist them coming over to Ireland and taking over, really. And to have the kind of the brazenness then to fight that off and say, you know what, I think or humour might work across the water. I mean, it's a remarkable story from there on that Paddy Power used this kind of humorous shtick that they have. Yes, this idea that we're willing to offend and outrage everybody if it gets to our target audience, young men, and makes them laugh. I mean, they saw an opportunity and they were willing to kind of follow through on that in a way that saw them grow remarkably, both in Britain and then on to Australia. And of course, nowadays, on to North America, where they're kind of, you know, arguably they're one of the biggest firms on the planet now as Flutter.com.
And, although they are struggling a bit because of prediction markets, they didn't see what was coming in the non-sports things. But another thing which really strikes me, and you do focus on it as well, is that nobody seems really willing to confront this. British and Irish governments, because of the tax revenues that are coming in, seem happy enough to continue with the way things are going. And then also leaving it to people to sort of self-regulate. Even the advertising which is done, when the fun stops, stop gambling. Yeah, that'll work, won't it?
Yeah, you're really talking about two key aspects of the playbook there. The first being kind of I guess the commandeering of politics and politicians and policymakers with the promise of tax revenues. And where that really came home to me is the expansion to North America, where by the time this playbook made it to North America, I mean, states were won over so easily. I saw Ontario and kind of Canada embrace the same tactics very, very quickly. And of course, yeah, the other end of that is people self-regulating, what is known the genius invention of responsible gambling, which is the other part of this. And that is what's, you know, one academic called the ultimate fig leaf for the industry, in the sense that this idea of responsible gambling is a framing that didn't exist before the turn of the century. Yes, these are new age terms. That was vitally important to everything that happens, in the sense that at every turn, it individualizes the harm and deflects our attention away from people to products, from the products to the people, the wrong way around there. And this idea that people, if they're informed consumers, should be left to self-regulate, despite the fact that we've got products that are designed by technologies we don't understand very well. We have corporate practices that are not being regulated suitably. And so the book lays out the need to find a better balance between, you know, our focus on people here, but also the products and the practices.
But finally, Dara, I'm sure many people have said to you as well, you know, this is a matter of individual choice. And if some people are unfortunate enough to fall into addiction, well, that can be dealt with. But it's the same as with alcohol and with other things, that for many people, they're able to have a drink or able to have a bet safely without it becoming a problem for them. What do you say to that?
I say to that 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 is a very myopic view and relies on a very narrow conception of big industry. It also lacks precedent. Yes, look at the tobacco industry. Look at the alcohol industry. A couple of decades ago, we thought they were okay to be in sport. We considered it kind of morally appropriate. And the moment came where we learned more about those industries, and suitably public health kind of, you know, won out. And I would argue that the moment is coming in terms of gambling as well. And that's not for gambling to disappear. Gambling's going nowhere. But to simply recognize what we had long known, that gambling is a known addictive product that does carry a risk of harm and hence needs to be treated as such.
Dara McGee, thank you so much for being with us. The book is called Imitation Games: How Gambling Hijacked Sport.
The Last Word with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.